From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South, recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story as if they were sitting on the porch with you. So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Brad Williams and Isaac Alexander? Did y'all like their music? Brad Williams is the frontman for the highly acclaimed band The Salty Dogs, which Jason Ringenberg called good, hardcore, salt-of-the-earth country. Isaac Alexander is the creative face of Little Rock. When Isaac's not fronting bands, playing drums, kissing babies, and writing songs, he punches the time clock at local ad agency giant Eric, Rob, and Isaac. Isaac can be seen around town performing with bands such as Big Silver, Boondogs, The Easies, and Greer's Ferry. Isaac is currently finishing up on his second solo album on Max Recordings. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark played on the late legendary bluesman John Weston CDs, Got to Deal with the Blues, and Blues at Daybreak. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? In this week's stories, our riders are all lost in the woods, and it takes more than a map to help them find their way home. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Mary Shelton and her sister follow a golden path into the forest that then disappears. And we'll end the night with Russell Gayer as the woods conspire against him. But let's start the night with Trey Moore as his solo hike takes a serious turn in When Everything Went Wrong in the Washitas.
The cold January rain poured down hard, and a fierce breeze howled across the mountain, and all my gear was drenched. I shivered, and a gust of wind blasted my campsite. It sounded like a gun went off and my tarp was thrown from its stakes, and I was truly at the mercy of the storm. Many things led me to this cold, wet place on the ground beside Forest Road 76. I wasn't properly fit for back-to-back 15 and 20 mile days. I was carrying far too much weight for the pack I had selected, and I was trying to go fully unsupported. No food drops, no caches, fast, with untested homemade equipment. I had hiked nearly 90 miles in just over 5 days. Alone, I had gotten lost. Earlier that day, somewhere around mile 80, I had stumbled down a steep rocky gully, and I felt the bones in my right knee shift and grind into one another, and sharp pains fired off in my legs. Now, my cardio was top-notch, but my legs simply couldn't take the everyday impact of 20-mile days. So, putting my pride aside, I moved toward an evacuation route down the next forest road that the trail crossed, and I referenced my map, and I headed south to what I thought was Highway 76. Now, after 2 hours of dirt road walking, I came to Forest Road 76. What I was hoping to be a busy highway to Union Grove, Arkansas, was actually a dirt path through the same woods that I'd spent nearly a week traversing. So I again referenced the map. At this point, I felt lost and confused. And I checked the horizon, I figured about 3 more hours of sunlight. And I found where the forest road and the trail intersected at mile 85, and I plotted out an evacuation route to Highway 270 from there. As I was turning in, it began to rain, just a little at first, but the winds then picked up. At this point, I had been supremely lucky with weather all week. Plenty of sweet, starry nights, and I never even thought about setting up my tarp. And then thunder came. At first, it was relaxing hearing the rain. I was drifting off to sleep, enjoying the storm. But as the winds whipped, my tarp started slapping cold, wet stings against my nylon hammock. Now, down does not insulate well when wet, and my sleeping bag was getting soggy, so I made moves to adjust my tarp, hoping getting my tarp off the hammock would solve the soaking problem. But it didn't. I had been hiking for hours to find this site. I hiked up rolling hills and down small mountains. I passed a lovely creek. I watched woodpeckers play. I hiked into the dark. The forecast had called for severe storms, and Mother Nature would be sure to deliver. I finally picked up a faint trail marker in the woods on the left, and a short way past this blue blaze was a small clearing with good trees to sling my hammock. I dropped my pack and quickly made camp, stringing up the hammock, blowing up my air mattress, laying out my sleeping bag, and setting my tarp, a homemade Tyvek project that I had put together in an afternoon, and this was going to be its first real test. So I had dinner twice, I hung my bear bag, and finally I got my feet out of my boots and surveyed the damage. My knee was swollen and bruised, and I had sharp pains in my ankles and shins, and my feet were a wreck. They were battered, blistered, and bashed, so I massaged my tired feet and my weary knees. Expecting the cold, rainy night ahead, I slipped on my rain pants for warmth, and I tipped back in my hammock to read a little while before bed. So it turns out Tyvek isn't as waterproof as I'd hoped, right? It leaked like a sieve. The water came through, dripped all over as it rained harder and harder, and the thunder clapped louder and louder. I decided to go to the ground. I adjusted the tarp, stringing it steep, trying to get the water to roll off before leaking through, and I crawled into my hammock, which was now a de facto bivy. I struggled for warmth throughout the night. A few hours in, I found an emergency poncho in my pack, and I wrapped my legs in it. Now, miraculously, I would be able to keep my feet and the socks they were in dry all through the night. I also cracked a couple of pre-packed hand warmers, and I put one directly on my neck, and I traded the other from hand to hand throughout the night. I rolled over repeatedly, tossing and turning, facing my back to the swirling winds, shivering and struggling to fight hypothermia. Now, I never panicked. I knew this was temporary. I knew I would make it out. Now, I did get frustrated. I did get angry. After 5 hours, I was in a definite state of shock, and from then on out, I had brief battles to all-out war with violent shaking fits. Labored breathing would have me fighting hyperventilation until the morning. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Our greatest glory is not in never failing, but in rising up every time that we fail." And then came the morning light. It was still raining steady, as it had been for the past 12 hours, but now there was light, and I mustered what little strength I had, and I began breaking camp. Everything dripped. I wrung out what I could. I packed it all away. I placed my dry socks into wet boots and I hiked. I hiked fast and I hiked hard. I knew my legs were hurting, but I couldn't feel it from the adrenaline rush. I had survived. I kept tight. I held my core temperature up. I was standing and I was on my way out. The little creek that I had passed the day before was now pumped up from the downpour, so I scouted rapids and drops that came quickly one after another. And the water now soothed my nerves. In the evening, it was my enemy. In the evening, it was my nemesis. I cursed it. I threatened it. I dared it to do its worst. And now I realize why I love it. Even in this state of pain, I was able to recognize where my bliss lay. Here in these places, among the mountains and the birds, the creeks and the streams, the blue sky, the trees and leaves, and yes, the wind, the rain, the thunder, and the lightning. I had made mistakes, but I was making progress. As I followed the creek, it crossed the road. I was swollen over its banks, it crested over the gravel. Now, the current was calf deep and swift, but it wasn't too threatening. However, after crossing the creek, my feet at this point were undeniably wet. So I hiked on. I was telling myself that the sounds ahead were just my imagination, just the wind, the thunder, or an airplane. Don't get too worked up. You've got over an hour or more of hiking, I told myself. But then the trees opened and my imagination gave way to reality. A road, a real paved blacktop road with white and yellow stripes. Within moments, a car came around the bend. I waved my trekking poles above my head and I held my thumb out. And they sped by, splashing dirty water on me as they went. This happened several times over. I attempted to hitch for over 30 minutes, and it seemed as it was always a shiny white sedan zooming by and splashing me as they went. So I was about to start walking down the highway when a black Nissan Pathfinder finally pulled over. I jogged my jostled knees over to the car, and I asked if I could get a ride to the next town, and a friendly Mexican man smiled, showing no front teeth, and he simply said, "Okay." His lady seemed a little perturbed by the situation, but I hopped in the back anyway. Their seat was instantly soaking wet, and the mariachi music was playing softly as I listened to the couple quietly talking up front. It was soothing to hear a language I was familiar with but still didn't quite grasp. I imagined they were discussing the silly things people like me do for entertainment, and I slipped into a deep sleep. I awoke as we were passing Mount Ida. The friendly driver asked me, "Where do you stay?" I said Little Rock, and before I could say but, he responded, "Oh, we're going to Little Rock. We take you." I said, "Gracias," and fell back asleep, trusting kind strangers to deliver me home. I woke up as we passed Ashley Furniture. We were driving down I-30, and we headed to the Geyer Springs exit and stopped at a gas station. My legs creaked and groaned as I stepped out of the car, and then I spoke. Por favor, mi español es no bueno. Muchas, muchas gracias. Muchas gracias para mi vida. Su es mi hermano, su es mi hermana. Mucho gusto, muchas gracias. The once perturbed lady now smiled sweetly and said, "Bless you. Yo soy Yolanda." I finally introduced myself. Yo soy Trey. The friendly driver said to me, "Yo soy Elias." They blessed me and wished me well, and I said to them, "Be well, my friends," as I walked to Wendy's. Now, I walked up the street to Wendy's, and I ordered some food, and I called Scott to pick me up. At this point, I had escaped the most miserable night in my life, and today I felt truly alive. All night, I felt I was being punished for some sort of karmic debt, and this morning, I watched as two people freely paid it forward, just out of the goodness of their own hearts. I was graced with the longest hitchhike of my life out of the woods and back home, by the grace of Yolanda and Elias, by the grace of God and the universe, back home.
Trey Moore works professionally in the outdoor industry. He is a Leave No Trace master educator, wilderness first responder, and whitewater canoe instructor. Trey guides treks in the Grand Canyon, whitewater rafting trips in the Smokies, and is co-owner of Arkansas-based adventure company Golden Circle Guides at gcguides.org. In our next story, Mary Shelton and her sister go where they are not allowed to and soon discover they have no idea where they are in forbidden territory.
The bio woods that we were not allowed to go into were not at all like Mama had told us they were. My sister Terry and I were literally wrapped in our own winter wonderland. I was 10. Terry was 8, and we walked wide-eyed on the fresh fallen snow as it glistened in the sunrise. Suddenly, we were entranced with a golden path that led us deeper and deeper into the woods. We forgot all about Mama's warnings as we wandered along that path, caught up in the natural beauty that surrounded us. We skated across a small pond as we continued to explore the forbidden territory. Earlier that morning, we had awoken to a sea of orange hats and vests. Nearly every man in the community had gathered in Mama's kitchen before the big deer hunt. Carl, one of our big brothers, was always sensitive to the needs of his little sisters, and he spotted Terry and I behind the old wood stove. He knew that we wanted in on the excitement. Quietly, he pulled us aside and laid out the perfect plan. We would start the hounds running for the hunt. 30 minutes after the hunters had all departed for the woods and settled into position where they would wait for that special buck to make his appearance, we were to execute the glorious plan. Just after the last truck had rumbled out of the driveway, we bundled up and ran across the snow-covered field to where the old hounds were caged. With every last barking dog secured to a leash, we started down the road that led to the big woods with the bow. Carl had instructed us to lead the hounds to the edge of the bow and then start them running to scare up the deer. We had never run the dogs before, so we carefully quizzed him to get his plan just right. He assured us that we could handle the task. Just don't worry. All we had to do was unleash the dogs and then begin to whoop and holler as loud as we could as we ran after the dogs. Upon execution of that great plan, the last sight we had of the hounds was a flurry of legs and tails scurrying through the snow-covered woods. We did not want to return home and let it be known that we had lost charge of our dogs within seconds of the time we unleashed them. So we decided that we would explore these deep woods. Mama would never let us go there before, and we were going to really enjoy it. She told us that we might fall into the bow and drown in its murky depths. We were in new territory. We had never been in the bow woods. We had never gotten to go deer hunting. and we had certainly never had the privilege of starting the hounds on their chase. However, after following the golden path deep into the woods, we suddenly realized it was no longer leading us. The sun was rapidly moving, but worse yet, we had no idea where we were. From the position of the sun, we finally determined which direction that home should be. We began to pick our way through the woods. Our winter wonderland had become a forest of long, dark shadows. Attempting to keep our spirits up, we trudged on. Where did this large irrigation canal come from? We did not remember crossing a canal, but one thing was certain, a big canal lay between us and home, and we must find a way to cross it. The canal banks were deep, I mean really deep, but some places the water level was down and the water wasn't too wide. We'd been jumping ditches all our life, so surely we could find a place that we could just jump across. So after sliding down the steep bank and jumping safely to the other side of the half-frozen water, we realized that we had another dilemma. The bank was too steep and slippery for us to climb out. We could do this, just stay calm and think it through. We began to walk the water's edge. It seemed that we had walked for miles before we finally saw a scrawny little elm on the bank. Try as we might, we could neither one jump high enough to catch a hold of the overhanging branch. So I cupped my hands together to lift Terry higher. It took every last ounce of my energy, but finally she grasped the limb. As she struggled toward the top of the bank, she suddenly let herself slip back down into the canal. I was really aggravated. How could she do that? I could not believe my eyes as she lay crumbled upon the icy ground. "What is the matter with you?" I screamed. "We were almost out of here." "You don't understand," she whispered. "There's a skunk lying under that tree." "You have to be kidding me. We have walked for miles, and that little tree is the only one that we have come to. I am not going to freeze to death in this canal." "So, do you have a better idea?" she asked. "Yes, I do. I am going to lift you back up one more time. Just maybe that skunk will be asleep. And if we are real quiet, maybe we can sneak by it." "You are crazy," she scowled. "I am not crawling up to a tree with a skunk sleeping under it." "Do you have any better idea?" I asked. "No? Well, then step in my hand and get a hold of that limb." It was getting colder, and the sun was beginning to fade. So Terry defiantly used the stirrup I had formed with my hands and stretched for the branch. As she raised herself up, she looked back and said, "The skunk is still right where it was, and I am not going any farther." I warned her to not even think about it. We had to get out of this canal. Stealthily, she proceeded over the bank. The skunk never moved. She found a stick, and she gently prodded the furry animal. Still, it did not move. Then she flipped the black flurry mass over. The skunk was as dead as a doorknob. After having a good laugh, she lay down in the snow and extended her hand downward and pulled me up from the canal. We had done it. We were not going to freeze to death in that canal. As we hurried out of the woods, we came to a field that we halfway recognized. We had only one thing in mind, the comfort of home. We didn't seem nearly as cold as we rushed across the field. We ran all the way home, never taking our eyes off that little gray curl at the top of the house. We hurried onto the back porch, shucked the wet boots and socks, and burst into the warm kitchen. Mama looked up from the cook stove. "Where have you girls been for so long?" We quickly responded. We were running the hounds for the coon hunters. As we rushed into the living room, to the comforts of the old wood stove, we were greeted by the same sea of orange vests and hats from earlier that morning. "What are you doing here?" we asked. Some wild, crazy idiots were running and whooping through the woods and scared every living creature, including us, out of the woods, so we all just came home. I felt my stomach turn as I quietly said, "Carl told us to start the dogs running, and we followed his instructions explicitly." Then my stomach turned again. I had not once thought of those dogs since we had unleashed them. I threw my hands to my mouth and I yelled, "Oh my gosh, what about the hounds? They must still be running. Come on, we've got to go get them. They will have run off of the face of the earth by now." Mama strolled in quietly from the kitchen and responded, "Oh, don't worry about those old hounds. You scared them out of the woods, too." They were home within 30 minutes from the time that you left the barnyard. All I had to do was open the gate, and they shot into their warm, cozy houses. By the way, when you girls get your feet thawed out, why don't you come on in and get your fill of these chicken and dumplings and cherry cobbler that everyone else has been feasting on all day.
Mary Shelton was the eighth of 13 children raised near Stuttgart, Arkansas. After working as a hairstylist for 35 years, Mary received her bachelor's and master's degrees in the fine arts. Mary is a painter, printmaker, and pen and ink artist. In our final story of the night, Russell Geyer is walking along when suddenly the familiar woods become foreign in Lost at Peter Bottom.
The trail disappeared. In my limited experience as a six-year-old boy, I'd never seen a trail in northwest Arkansas, or anywhere else for that matter, just up and disappear, and without a trace. One minute I was plodding along in complete confidence that the route to my destination would be as swift and trouble-free as devouring one of the homemade fried pies my mother had prepared for our lunch, when from out of nowhere, and without the slightest forewarning, the darn thing just evaporated. Even worse, the path behind me took notice and decided to join its evil twin in participating in this cruel prank. Realizing that I was sorely misplaced and my sense of direction in a severe need of an extensive overhaul, I did the only logical thing. I panicked. Words from my epitaph played on the phonograph inside my head. "Boy of six, lost at Peter Bottom on Warrego River, his body never found." How the relatives would cry and carry on. "He was such a sweet boy," said the old women from church. "That boy loved to play baseball. Might have made it to the majors, too," the kindly old gentleman down the road would remark. The sun bore down intensely from its position directly overhead. Mr. Solar Power could have helped me if he wanted to, by sliding to the east or west, or at least providing a shadow by which I might gain some great and powerful revelation of divine nature. But no. He chose to remain motionless, even convincing the wind to cease, as to render the impression that time had indeed stood still. The scenery looked the same in every direction. Ragweeds and river canes soared into the air, their towering stalks crowded into immense jungle that was at least 200 feet tall. The wind returned as a gentle breeze, slithering its way through the weeds to create an evil hiss. Hair stood on the back of my neck. Goosebumps raced down my arm, and a lump the size of a pumpkin took up residence in my throat. River bottoms are notorious for snakes, vicious copperheads, loathsome water moccasins, an occasional rattler, and the ever bloodthirsty cottonmouth were all known to call this stretch a bottomland home. And rumor was, they weren't crazy about visitors either. I began to question the wisdom of leaving Uncle Harry on the comfortable stretch of gravel bar below the shoal. It was peaceful there. 100-year-old trees rose stately from the riverbank. Their magnificent canopies cast a cool and welcome shade on the bleached white gravels. There were rocks to skip and mussel shells to scoop sand from the water's edge. Why did I ever leave the safety and security of such an oasis? The answer is simple. Greed. This was a fishing trip. The primary goal of a fishing trip is to catch fish. We had worked this hole for quite a while with no success, and I had tried various types of bait, often them leaving them in the same spot for an eternity of 2 whole minutes without even getting a single nibble. Frustration mounted, and each passing moment, the length of my patience could be measured against the point of a hook, with plenty of room to spare. The waiting game didn't seem to bother Uncle Harry. When the going got slow, he would pull a tin of velvet from his overall bibs and roll a cigarette. Each time he started this process, a fish close to the surface would relay a message to another at the end of the line to give the bait a couple of quick jerks. This would throw Uncle Harry into a quandary, not knowing whether to pour the tobacco back in the tin or finish the cigarette, and by the time he came to a decision and picked up the rod, the jerking would cease. Tiny bubbles popped to the surface near the line, evidence that the fish were having quite a chuckle at Harry's expense. My father had taken up residence about 100 yards downriver. We could easily see him sitting on the edge of a mud bank with his rods propped in forked sticks. The roar of the water tumbling down the rocky shoal made it difficult to communicate. But after much loud hollering and waving of arms, I was granted permission to leave the gravel bar and traverse the short distance from one outpost to the next. I presumed this would be an easy task. After all, I'd been on several such expeditions with Dad and Uncle Harry, and I was a seasoned veteran of following riverbank trails, or so I thought. Now, I found myself in the midst of an endless jungle, surrounded by thousands of snakes and several hundred unscrupulous wild beasts, all ready to sink their teeth into my tender young flesh. It was time to call upon the survival knowledge I had accumulated during my 6 short years, and often put to the test under such circumstances.
Daddy!
I screamed.
Where are you?
Over here. It was hard to get a bearing on his muffled reply above the thrashing of canes and crush of leaves beneath my small, rapidly churning feet. First, I darted to one direction. Then I'd stop and holler again. Now the sound of Dad's voice was coming from a different place. Had he moved? Charging forth another 10 yards, I repeated the procedure. This went on for some time with both of us hollering back and forth and me finally gathering sufficient horse sense to remain quiet long enough to gain bead on his position. My throat was dry and hoarse by the time a thin spot appeared in the canes. From this vantage point, I could see a bluff on the far bank, and I knew I was approaching the river's edge. 2 steps ahead lay the trail. Why it chose to magically reappear is unbeknownst to me. Perhaps it was tired of our little game, or maybe the screaming and crying had begun to wear on its nerves. In either case, it spat me out on top of the bank near my father. Dad welcomed me with oakum arms, and after a brief but painless lecture, reached into his old canvas fishing bag and rewarded me with the tastiest fried pie that ever slid between a set of teeth and gums. What a glorious homecoming that was! And it reminds me of a passage of scripture. My son was lost, but now is found. Let us kill the fatted pie and rejoice!
Russell Gayer is a 4th-generation Ozark native residing in the original family homestead near Goshen, Arkansas. His humorous short stories and essays have been published in various anthologies and online at frontiertales.com. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website, and we are open for submissions from Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.